Welcome to Deception in the Last Days with your host, Randy Shelton. Randy is a member of the Biblical Discernment and Research Center. He has been studying cults and new religious movements for over 30 years. Join Randy as he discerns the deception going on now in the last days.
Welcome to Deception in the Last Days. This is part 47 of Liberalism, the New Improved Broad Road to Destruction. Now, I'm going to be continuing with our look at the ghost of liberalism present by repeating a quote that I ended last week's program with that also represents the ghost of liberalism past. This is from an article called What's Wrong with Christian Fundamentalism. And it says, going back to Rick Warren's definition of fundamentalism on page 21, Rick said, now the word fundamentalist actually comes from a document in the 20s called the Five Fundamentals of the Faith. And it is a very legalistic, narrow view of Christianity. And when I say there are very few fundamentalists, I mean in the sense that they are actually called fundamentalist churches, and those would be quite small. There are no large ones. In response to Rick Warren's understanding of fundamentalism, we need to recall the document in the 20s called the Five Fundamentals of the Faith that he calls a very legalistic, narrow view of Christianity. I would recommend the definition given by the most comprehensive researcher of our time concerning fundamentalism in American culture, George Marston. He says, in 1910, Presbyterian General Assembly, who in response to some questions raised about the orthodoxy of some of the graduates of Union Theological Seminary, which is a very liberal seminary, adopted a five-point declaration of essential doctrines. These were summarized as follows. The inerrancy of Scripture, number two, the virgin birth of Christ, number three, Christ's substitutionary atonement, four, Christ's bodily resurrection, and five, the authenticity of Christ's miracles. And of course, these are five of what we would call the essential doctrines of the faith today. Now, also from Ken Silva's article called Pseudo-Mission, One Size Fits All Social Gospel, regarding Rick Warren, he says, purpose-driven is a one-size-fits-all plan and program. It is the ultimate ecumenical tool. From the statements given to the press by Rick Warren, it is clear that gospel has been removed from the scene. In its place is a social gospel. In other words, the true gospel has been removed. In its place is a social gospel, a new global ethic that tastes like lukewarm leftover evangelicism. Of course, like I say, we're doing a little review here and repeat. The next thing I wanted to quote from is from a book called God versus Socialism. It says the social gospel and the social justice message is an apostasy. Apostasy means a departure from the faith or one who denies the fundamental doctrines concerning the person and work of Jesus Christ. Social justice teachings have branched off from the emergent church, which of course is another term for liberalism today. We can no longer deny the fact that humanism, liberalism, and the secular progressive movement are alive and well in the church, just as it has been for years in government, education, media, and the entertainment industry. Remember that the fundamentalists, of course, were battling that social gospel that the modernists, which was the term they used for their liberal views, they called themselves modernists, which today would be called progressives, as we look at the ghost of liberalism present. And they were trying to promote, progressives or the modernists of their day were trying to promote to replace the authentic biblical gospel, of course, with the social gospel. Now, I have an article from the Berean Call called The Social Gospel, Council of Churches and Fabian Socialism. In fact, I have two articles here that I'm going to quote from concerning the social gospel. And the other one is concerning, the article title is, No, Jesus Was Not a Socialist. Now, from this article, the date October 5th, 2015, we read, from the Social Gospel Councils of Churches and Fabian Socialism, we read, called Father of the Social Gospel, Walter Rauschenbusch, and I've spoken of him in the past podcasts before. He grew up in a German Lutheran immigrant family in New York. He was the faculty member at Rochester Theological Seminary. He became its professor of church history. And from that prominent platform, he wrote books such as Christianizing the Social Order and A Theology for the Social Gospel. Rauschenbusch introduced Jesus not as one who would come to save sinners from their sins, but as one who had a social passion for society. He and his comrades established the Brotherhood of the Kingdom, which unified like-minded church leaders under a common socialist quest for an earthly kingdom of God. Their plan would fit our times. It called for political reform, ecumenical unity, social justice, and global peace. To justify its place in Christian theology, words like redemption and regeneration were redefined to fit their socialistic ideals. The article goes on to say, sounds familiar, doesn't it? Popular church leaders use the same strategy today. And of course, it mentions Brian McLaren. And of course, we will look more at the emerging church of which he's associated with when we get to the Ghost of Liberalism Future in future podcasts. Now, the next article from the Berean Call. No, Jesus was not a socialist. It says, according to a new poll from the Barna Group, Americans think Jesus was a socialist who would vote for Bernie Sanders. Of course, we're past the election now. But it says, when asked whether capitalism or socialism best aligned with the teachings of Jesus, 24% said socialism and just 14% answered capitalism. The rest answered neither or not sure. Socialism is based on the involuntary transfer of wealth from some citizens to others, which is nothing but theft. Tell it like it is. But even a cursory review of the parables of Jesus reveals that he was anything but a socialist. In his parable of the talents in Matthew 25, 14 through 30, for instance, the main character is an entrepreneur who recruits three employees to manage his property while he is gone on a trip. Note that the property was his own and not the state's. The story is predicated on the concept of private property. And the entrepreneur entrusts his property to his employees based on merit, not on affirmative action, quotas, or any other such thing. He gave to each according to his ability. Note how socialism is upended right out of the chute. Socialism piously asserts to each according to his need, while in Jesus' worldview it's just the reverse. The owner expected them to work hard, invest, and return a profit on what he had entrusted to them. And he held them accountable through performance reviews upon his return. He goes on to say, the employee who buried his talent in the backyard received no sympathy from the owner. Rather, he was rebuked as a wicked and slothful servant. This is not to say that Christianity does not teach the redistribution of wealth. Christians believe in the redistribution of wealth just as passionately as the most ardent socialists. We simply believe that the redistribution of wealth is to be voluntarily, not involuntarily. While liberals believe generosity is giving away other people's money, followers of Christ believe generosity is giving away our own money, motivated by compassion for the poor. And this was C. Richard Fisher, I believe, wrote this article, and of course it was picked up by the Berean Call, originally from One News Now Online, May 18th, 2016. Okay, now I want to give you a thumbnail sketch of some of the movers and the shakers of what would be known as progressive Christians, the progressive Christian movement. And of course, there's some overlap. Some of these folks might fall into some of the other categories as well, red letter Christians or emergence or whatever. But we're kind of concentrating on progressive red letter type Christians at this point. Now, a woman named Karen Armstrong, who I have in the past quoted, actually used one of her books in the history of fundamentalism, The Battle for God, actually was the name of the book, because I thought that she had done a pretty good job, and I wanted to point out, you know, some of the fallacies of her liberal ideas as well. But anyway, Karen Armstrong, she was a liberal member of the Jesus Seminar, who I've mentioned before, and frequent guest on secular TV specials on the Bible. She's an ex-Catholic and now a freelance monotheist. She denies that the Bible teaches any clear theology or relevant ethics, and that even God's behavior occasionally leaves something to be desired. And I start off with Miss Armstrong, or Mrs. Armstrong, I'm not sure, because recently I saw an article entitled 15 Useful Infidels for Muslim Brotherhood in America. And I thought it was pretty interesting when I saw that name, and I realized, it's the same Karen Armstrong, not surprisingly. But anyway, I'll read a little bit from this article posted by Leo Holman, 12/28/2016. It says that everyone has heard of useful idiots, a term coined decades ago and widely attributed to Vladimir Lenin, the leader of Russia's Bolshevik Revolution, who promised to bring down capitalism from within. But the Muslim Brotherhood, a leader in the global Islamic movement, learned a lot of tricks from its old communist buddies, say those who have studied the organization. To accomplish the task of infiltrating and destroying from within, the Brotherhood needs useful idiots, just like the communists did. Now a group of researchers has exposed the identities of some of these pawns, and the Middle East Forum, which is headed by the noted historian and Islam scholar Daniel Pipes, puts a new twist on the old theme by calling those on the list useful infidels. You know, an infidel is the term that Muslims uses for people who are not part of their faith. They have published a field guide to useful infidels for journalists that includes what it believes are 15 pro-Islamist puppets. Among them are politicians like Chris Christie, CNN reporter Christiane Amanpour, who's with CNN, I think I already mentioned that, actor Ben Affleck, and Secretary of State John Kerry. Of course, of these 15, there are those that are found on the left as well as on the right. But Ben Affleck, of course, is a noted liberal. And but anyway, moving on to the subject of the particular individual I wanted to spend a little more time with, Karen Armstrong, is on the list. And she's a British-born writer and broadcaster. Two of her early books charted the course she would take as an intellectual. 1991's Muhammad, a biography of the Prophet, which won the Muslim Public Affairs Council Media Award, and 1993's A History of God, the 4,000-year quest of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Okay. And, of course, I mentioned the aforementioned Battle for God, which I had quoted from an earlier podcast. She later penned Muhammad, a Prophet for Our Time. It says, every fundamentalist movement that I've studied, she says, in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, is rooted in a profound fear of annihilation, Armstrong once wrote. Armstrong spoke at the 2012 annual convention of the Islamic Society of North America, an organization originally founded by Muslim Brotherhood activists and named as a co-conspirator in the 2008 Holy Land Foundation trial. Now, this, once again, I used the phrase in an earlier podcast of where liberalism can take you at that time, showing where liberalism took some of its key proponents into outright occultism. Well, here's a Jesus Seminar member, Karen Armstrong, and progressive so-called Christian, and I don't know why she would want to call herself a Christian, and where liberalism has taken her, as you can see. Now, some of the other progressives, liberals, that I would like to give a little thumbnail sketch of are people like Marcus Borg. And let's see here. I've got his information here. He's a liberal religion professor at Oregon State and fellow of the Jesus Seminar. A Lutheran by heritage and an admirer of Paul Tillich, who we've discussed in the past, Borg rejects the idea that Christianity is about belief in certain historical events or factual statements about the supernatural. He prefers to focus on the lenses through which we see reality and the importance of seeing the truth in biblical stories, even though they did not really happen. Well, there's an exercise in futility, in my opinion, but again, that's where liberalism can take you. The next noted progressive that I would like to mention would be Tony Campolo. Spoken of him before. He's a liberal American Baptist founder. Of course, he calls himself an evangelical. In fact, he's the founder of the Evangelical Association for the Promotion of Education. I think that's misleading when he says he's an evangelical, since there was a time when most people thought evangelicals were conservative, but that was at a different point in time, of course. Anyway, it says he's the former sociology chair at Eastern College, an entertaining and powerful speaker for social activism. Campolo is highly critical of fundamentalism and is an important member of the egalitarian organization Christians for Biblical Equality. He mixes elements of conservative theology with pantheism and even more liberal concepts. Now, that's pretty liberal when you get more liberal than pantheism, but in this biographer's comments, that's his point of view. And of course, he's several books he's written. I won't take the time here for that. John Dominique Crossan, the liberal professor from DePaul University, which is a Catholic university in Chicago, and former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar. He also chairs the historical Jesus section of the Society of Biblical Literature. Crossan believes Jesus' body was destroyed by dogs. And I mean, it's not really funny, but, you know, where does he get this stuff, right? And that the apostles did not intend the doctrine of the resurrection to be taken literally. He tends to take a dramatic or allegorical approach to the Bible, as opposed to a literal approach, of course, allegorical. So enough about Mr. Crossan. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his last name correct or not, but anyway, another pretty well-known progressive. The next man who I've mentioned on several occasions, Robert Funk, a panentheist, former executive secretary for the Society of Biblical Literature, and founder of the Jesus Seminar. He is also, for what it's worth, one of the most credentialed liberal biblical scholars, I should say, in the world. Well, liberal as well. Funk's vision of reformation for Christianity goes beyond liberalism, denouncing the existence of a personal God, the possibility of miracles or answered prayer, the deity, virgin birth, atoning death, and resurrection of Christ, all end-time prophecy, and virtually every other historical doctrine of Christianity. So I guess you could say he is all in with, or he was before he passed, and he is actually from my hometown in Evansville, Indiana, which I'm not particularly proud of, let's say, but anyway, another leading progressive who has passed on. Now, next, we want to listen to, well, this might surprise some of you, probably not in my audience, Norman Vincent Peale, the liberal minister and founder of the Foundation for Christian Living. He also has passed on in 1993, actually. The widely quoted Peale focused on an optimistic view of humanity and its potential to overcome sin. A pioneer of the liberal approach to Christian psychology, he taught that positive thinking could perform greater miracles than faith in the supernatural. Peale's theology had a great influence on Robert Schuller and some leaders in the Word of Faith movement. And of course, Robert Schuller had influence on Rick Warren and the man up at Willow Creek, whose name escapes me right now, but we'll get around to him on down the road, I'm sure. But the point is, I'm trying to make is that Peale, Vincent, influenced Schuller. Schuller had his influence and on down the road. And that's why later, if I have time in this podcast, or if not in the next, I will spend a little more time with Robert Schuller. Because, you know, I'm talking about all these dead guys, right? But they still have influence, of course, through their ideas and through their thoughts. Bill Hybels, by the way, is the name of the man up at Willow Creek who was also influenced by Robert Schuller. Now, next is, of course, Robert Shuler, or actually A.T. Robinson. A.T. Robinson was also passed away, an English theologian at Trinity College in Cambridge. He died in 1983. You notice most of these guys have died fairly recently, so I'm including them along with, you know, the progressive movement as part of the ghost of liberalism present. But John Robinson, A.T. Robinson, was the English theologian at Trinity College in Cambridge who popularized death of God theology. Rejecting all miracles, he saw the resurrection and return of Christ not as historical events, but as an abiding presence. Not sure what that means. Anyway, unlike many liberals, he held to an early, pre-AD 70 date for the writing of the New Testament. One of his famous books was Honest to God. And then, of course, I mentioned Robert Shuler. We'll say a little bit more about him here. The liberal pastor also passed away at the Crystal Cathedral and host of the Hour of Power. Affiliated with the Reformed Church of America, his possibility thinking shows influence from Norman Vincent Peale. Shuler believes people don't need to be told they're sinners. They simply need to discover hope. Shuler is currently working to rebuild, or not anymore, but he was when this was written, currently working to build common ground with Muslims, with whom he says Christians share worship of the same God and equal reverence for Jesus. Of course, he wrote a ton of different books and was famous for the statement that he really found it appalling, or he really did not appreciate the quote or the expression for those who would say, "I find Peale," referring to Norman Vincent Peale, "appalling, and Paul," referring to the Apostle Paul, "as appealing." You get it? Paul is very appealing, of course, because he was biblical. Peale was appalling because he was not. And Shuler didn't like that because he equally was not very biblical. Now, we can't forget Bishop Spong, who I've talked at great length before in the past, and then we'll have a couple others, and I see how my time is racing away here. But John Shelby Spong, he's still with us, as far as I know, up till today. It says he's the openly atheistic Anglican bishop of Newark. His mission is to move Christianity away from its ties to God in the Bible so it can survive in today's society. Yeah, he's talked about that before, how, you know, why Christianity must change or die. That was one of his famous books. Now, a couple of more. And this this is from the Spirituality and Practice website. They have what they call the Living Spiritual Teachers Project, wherein they lump together a lot of people that they believe to be spiritual teachers. And in fact, they are spiritual teachers. It's just the spirit that's leading them is what's in question here. I would say it's doctrines of demons and seducing spirits. But to these folks who are in spiritual darkness, they lump together many different people, including a couple of these so-called Christians or progressive Christians, together with occultists, Eastern religionists, and a wide bag of deceived folks, who they would all see as the living spiritual teachers. One of them, Desmond Tutu, yes, that's his real name for those who are not familiar with him. He, like Barack Obama, won a Nobel Peace Prize. I'm not sure exactly what what Barack Obama won his for, but I would assume that Tutu, as it says here, he's a Nobel Peace Prize laureate. So probably in spirituality or something along that lines, philosophy. He's retired as the Archbishop of Cape Town, South Africa, and chairman of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And of course, we'll say more about him down the road. We'll have some comments from one of his books in future podcasts. Then we have Jim Wallis, evangelical Christian activist for social change and justice, a commentator on ethics and public life, and the founder, and I think most significant, really, the founder and editor-in-chief of Sojourners Magazine. I think, I'm not 100% sure, but I believe George Soros may do a lot of the funding. I do know that Wallace was a spiritual advisor to Barack Obama during the election, and I think, I don't know if he claimed or if many people believe that he helped deliver as many as perhaps 25% of evangelical voters to vote for Barack Obama, which I don't consider really a good thing. But anyway, both of these individuals in the Living Spiritual Teachers Project are lumped right together here on these pages, web pages, with people like Eckhart Tolle, or Tolle, however you pronounce his name, one of Oprah's heroes, Oprah Winfrey's heroes, who's written several books, best-selling author on spirituality, and again, guess which spirits are behind his spirituality. He is a commentator on new consciousness, or really new age type beliefs, new age occultism, public speaker and seminary leader. And then you have Ken Wilber, transpersonal psychologist and philosopher, founder and president of the Integral Institute, and author of 22 books translated in up to 30 languages. I believe he may be Buddhist, but is definitely an influential New Age type author and proponent. These are just a couple. I could name other names. Lama Surya Das, who I have not heard of before, trained in the Tibetan Buddhism tradition, and you know, just several here that are listed, all grouped together with people like Jim Wallace, the evangelical Christian, and Desmond Tutu, the so-called, you know, progressive Christian. Wallace also is a progressive Christian. He may refer to himself as an evangelical, but he would also refer to himself as a progressive. Now, let's see if I made it through my list, because my time is just about up. Yes, I believe I have, except that I will probably also mention Bishop Eugene Robinson, since I probably will have some quotes from his book in some of the future work I'll be doing in The Ghost of Liberalism Present here. And he was, I think, the first openly gay bishop maybe ever anywhere, but at least of the Episcopal Church, which is the American version of the Anglican Church, or the Church of England. I think that would probably be a real good place to stop, since I'm just about out of time. But we will be back with you in part 47 next week, and I hope you'll join me as we continue to look at the ghost of liberalism present, and in these last days, as we look at deception in the last days.